Hello, I'm James Menendez. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Tuesday, the 6th of March. Coming up, with the UK Defence Secretary in Washington and Ukraine's President Zelensky saying he'll meet American officials in Saudi Arabia next week, President Trump continues to express ambivalence towards NATO. We'll hear from Washington. Also, after weeks of uncertainty about the Pope's health, a rare audio message for his well-wishers. And the viral photograph of a Canadian goose fending off an American eagle that's giving succour to Canadians. We'll speak to the photographer behind the shot. Despite a flurry of diplomatic activity to shore up the relationship between Europe and the United States this week and last week, President Trump's rhetorical barbs continue to cast doubt on some of the key pillars of Western security. While European countries today were scrambling to fill the void left by America's decision to suspend military aid to Ukraine, President Trump mused in the Oval Office tonight about the strength of the NATO commitment to defend a member who comes under attack. This is what he said a short time ago.
The biggest problem I have with NATO, I really, I know the guys very well. They're friends of mine. But if the United States was in trouble and we called them, we said, we got a problem, France. We got a problem, a couple of others I won't mention. Do you think they're going to come and protect us? They're supposed to. I'm not so sure. So with Japan.
Well, the comments come as Britain's Defence Secretary John Healey's been meeting his US counterpart, Pete Hegseth, in Washington. And we've also heard from Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky that he'll meet US officials in Saudi Arabia next week. Well, let's head to Washington now and speak to our correspondent, Nomir Iqbal. First of all, on NATO, what exactly has President Trump been saying?
Well, I mean, he talked about a lot of different issues, as he often does in the Oval Office. And he reiterated his stance, his long-running stance, that European partners need to step up defence spending. That's what he said when he was questioned on whether he might withdraw US funding from NATO. Just to quote him, he said, "It's common sense. If they don't pay, I'm not going to defend them." He was also asked about Emmanuel Macron's comments that France might extend its nuclear umbrella over its European partners. And basically, Mr. Trump said that he favours denuclearisation instead.
And the meeting between John Healey and Pete Hegseth, the US Defence Secretary, I mean, any signs from that meeting that he's managed to persuade the Pentagon to do more for Ukraine and perhaps reinstating that military aid that's been suspended?
I'm not sure. It doesn't look like it, to be honest. John Healey is very much on a PR mission here. You know, his trip comes after Sir Keir Starmer announced a rise in the UK's defence spending. And when he was asked about that, Mr. Healey said the US was right to make countries step up on spending and security. He said emphatically no when asked, is the US abandoning Ukraine or Europe? He said the US wants to see progress. He was asked about the intelligence, the pausing intelligence, and whether the UK was doing that, agreed with that, but he wouldn't be drawn into it. He basically said he didn't want to give a running commentary on the twists and turns, and particularly when it comes to intelligence matters.
Staying with Ukraine and the administration's effort to try to end the war in Ukraine, getting those peace talks started, we've had that news of talks, direct talks between President Zelensky and US officials, but not in Washington, in Saudi Arabia this time.
That's right. Saudi Arabia has become the country in which the US favours for these talks. They feel that it's the best country position to try and get Ukraine and Russia to the table. Donald Trump said today that he thinks Ukraine wants to make a deal, to quote him, because they don't have a choice. And he also went on to say that Russia wants to make a deal because, quoting Mr. Trump, in a certain different way, a different way that only I know, they have no choice either. So he didn't really elaborate on what that means. But a US delegation is currently planning to meet Ukrainian officials in Saudi Arabia next week. This involves his Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff. They want to come up with a framework for peace. Mr. Witkoff did say today that the letter that President Zelensky sent to Donald Trump after that blow up in the Oval Office was a very positive first step. Mr. Trump was asked whether he would be going to Saudi Arabia, and he said, "I don't know, I can't tell you." But he then said, "I am going to Saudi Arabia," although he seemed to suggest that he'd be going as his first foreign trip in the next 6 weeks. So not really sure if that would be related to Ukraine.
Nomia, thank you very much indeed. Our Washington correspondent Nomia Iqbal there. Well, all those developments in Washington come against the backdrop of today's summit of European Union leaders in Brussels, an emergency meeting called in the wake of America's decision to suspend that military aid to Ukraine. It ended with a broad statement of support for the country, something welcomed by Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, who was also there. However, the details of that support still need to be thrashed out. On the table, a European Commission proposal to spend an additional 800 billion euros on bolstering member states' armed forces over the coming years, and a plan led by the UK and France to create a coalition to underpin any future truce between Ukraine and Russia. Well, today the Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk said he was confident in Europe's ability to confront Russia.
Europe as a whole is really able to win any financial, economic or military confrontation with Russia. We're simply stronger. We just have to start believing in it. And today it is probably happening.
Not everyone, though, in the EU likes the idea of confronting Russia. The Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban didn't give his backing to today's statement of solidarity with Ukraine. And Slovakia's Prime Minister Robert Fico is another outlier. He's already said he'll oppose increasing defence spending in the EU and wants Ukraine to agree to an immediate ceasefire, a position that his opponents at home say aligns him with Vladimir Putin. I've been talking to the deputy leader of Mr. Fico's Smer party, Erik Kalinak, and asked him if Slovakia would support Ukraine in any possible peace agreement.
We are definitely backing Ukraine in any attempt to finally achieve peace or ceasefire. That is, for us, the first step that should be taken. What we don't support and what we are against is that ceasefire should not be based on having all the necessary security measures agreed beforehand. We need to have ceasefires first, and then we can, you know, iron out the wrinkles and the rest of the peace agreement.
And what specific security guarantees or measures are you opposed to? I mean, are you opposed to the idea of European countries putting boots on the ground?
Depends on whether they are putting their boots on the ground to fight the war or to maintain peace. That's two completely different things. If it's for the peace, as long as it's based, you know, on voluntary and bilateral agreements between the countries, we are not vetoing any of such agreements.
The trouble is, President Zelensky says that he doesn't trust Russia to keep the peace if there is a ceasefire. He says Russia has broken so many ceasefires in the past that there needs to be a cast iron deterrent. Do you agree with him?
I don't agree with going for another quasi-peace agreement. I want to see peace. I feel like the ceasefire is the first step towards it. I understand the skepticism. There is definitely valid reasons for that. But, you know, it's not about trusting Russia or Vladimir Putin. You don't have to trust him to have the agreement because there are other countries that should be the ones that guarantee that the peace will be lasting.
These talks about peace are in the very, very early stages at the moment. But do you agree with the way the Trump administration is going about it, already giving some way to Russia, particularly over territory, for example, saying it's, you know, probably going to be allowed to keep the territory it's taken? Do you agree with that approach, given that negotiations haven't really begun properly?
I welcome any and all realism, because the plans we had in past, which we agreed on in European Union, were, you know, noble for sure, but it had nothing to do with reality. I support Trump in any and all attempts to negotiate peace. And what is important is that it's real. It's, you know, it's focused on reality and not putting up demands that are not based on anything that can be achieved.
Your political opponents, in other words, the opponents of your party and your party leader, say that you're trying to turn Slovakia into a Russian province. Are they right?
Absolutely not. It's not what we are trying to do at all. As Prime Minister said many times, we are focusing on sovereign foreign policies. We want to have good economical ties to every and all countries. But our political home is definitely in the EU and NATO.
But thinking about relations with Russia, how important is it to Slovakia that gas from Russia flows once again through Ukraine? Because you're pretty dependent on that. Might that be part of a deal with the European Union? You support them in Ukraine if that gas starts to flow again?
Yes, it's definitely our main demand that there is a push from European Union to, on Ukraine to let the gas flow again from Russians. It is not about our dependency on it, but it's about, you know, transit costs and the transit fees. That is something that is economically very vital.
Can I just ask you this finally? I mean, does your party, when push comes to shove, does it support Ukraine over Russia?
In what sense? We want peace. We support peace. Whatever gets us peace, we support it. Obviously, we agree that it was Russians who broke the international law. It was Russians who attacked Ukraine. There is no doubt about it. But, you know, saying those two sentences doesn't change the fact that Russians are there. And unless we shift from militarizing Ukraine to saying, let's get peace, there won't be no peace.
Erik Kalinak, deputy leader of Slovakia's governing Smer party. Coming up later on the program.
I watched this bald eagle coming in, and it headed straight for a goose that was isolated, and it went in for the attack. I've never seen a bald eagle go in for a goose before. I was surprised that the bald eagle actually gave up.
The viral photo that Canadians have embraced as a metaphor for their pushback against Donald Trump's bellicose rhetoric. We'll be talking to the man who took the shot. Pope Francis has been in hospital for nearly 3 weeks now, gravely ill with double pneumonia. But today he was well enough to record an audio message, his first from his hospital bed, thanking those who've been praying for his recovery. He's saying, I thank you from the bottom of my heart for your prayers, for my health from the square. I'm with you from here. May God bless you and the Virgin protect you. Thank you. Well, Sarah Rainsford, our correspondent, is in Rome and was there as the message was played out to worshippers.
His voice is really, really strained and very, very weak. And even native Spanish speakers were struggling to make out his words. The Pope was speaking in Spanish, which is his first language. It was a very brief message, just 22 seconds. He was thanking people from the bottom of his heart, he said, thanking them for their prayers. Because this was a message that was played out to a crowd of hundreds of people who are gathered here on St. Peter's Square every evening for the past couple of weeks to pray for the Pope's health. They had come this evening having no idea that they were going to hear this audio, and I was watching their faces on the big screens as the Cardinal began the evening prayer by saying he had wonderful news. He said, this is a good day because the Holy Father has sent a message to everyone. And then I don't think people could really take it in. He was talking Italian. Many of the people in the crowd would not have spoken Italian. And then the audio played out very, very loudly across the square. But again, it was hard to make out. I'm not sure many people listening would have actually known what was going on. But eventually they realised, and there was a round of applause as the Pope's message ended. And I think, you know, a real mixture of relief, because it's the first that anyone outside of the hospital, Gemelli Hospital, has heard from the Pope for 3 weeks now. But also, I think, you know, continuing concern because he did sound so very weak.
Did the Vatican give any more information about his condition? Because it has been a perilous few days, hasn't it?
It really has. Monday was the third time that we were told that the Pope had had what they described as a respiratory crisis. In fact, I think they said it was respiratory failure on Monday, two episodes of that. So the third time that the Pope had been really in trouble with his breathing since he was admitted to hospital 3 weeks ago. Now, though, I think that this audio recording is part of a slightly more hopeful mood and messaging by the Vatican, because we've been told by the doctors this evening that the Pope is stable, and that's for the second or perhaps the third day that they've used that word. They even said that they're not going to give us another medical bulletin tomorrow, the doctors, that is, because they don't think anything will have changed. So I think that is definitely new. I mean, for the past 3 weeks, it's been very cautious, and it's been a very cautious Vatican too, sometimes a very worried-looking Vatican official who comes to speak to us and interpret the messaging. So I think, you know, there's definitely a new tone to it today. And just the fact that this audio came from the Pope, I think, gave many of the Catholics, certainly that I was speaking to here on the square, a reason to hope. And one of them said, what we want now is to actually see Pope Francis.
Sarah Rainsford speaking to me from Rome. Unprecedented was how police described the scale of Carl Clifford's crimes in terms of male violence against women and girls. Today, the 26-year-old from North London was found guilty of raping his ex-partner Louise Hunt before murdering her, her sister Hannah, and their mother Carol. He'd already admitted killing the two sisters with a crossbow and stabbing their mother in what was described as a carefully planned assault at the family's home in Hertfordshire. In court for today's verdict was Louise's father, the BBC racing commentator John Hunt. Well, today in the House of Commons, the Home Office Minister, Jess Phillips, remembered all the women who died at the hands of men over the past 12 months.
Sophie Evans, Joanne Samak, Carol Hunt, Louise Hunt, Hannah Hunt, Jenny Sharp, Alana Odysseus, Laura Robson.
And you heard there the names of Carol, Louise and Hannah Hunt in that list, which took almost 5 minutes to read out. It is a list which forms part of a new report by the Femicide Census called 2000 Women, an analysis of the deaths of 2000 women killed by men since 2009. Well, today the government reiterated its commitment to halving violence against women and girls within the next decade, part of Labour's manifesto at the election. I've been talking to Natalie Fleet. She sits on the Women's and Equalities Select Committee. I began, first of all, by asking for her reaction to that guilty verdict against Carl Clifford.
I'm just glad for the family and everybody involved that it's sorted. It didn't take the jury very long to come to a decision. It's absolutely horrendous. It just doesn't even bear thinking about. And it's really, really scary that there is reference to Andrew Tate in it, because it just makes you wonder what our boys and young people are watching.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, it did emerge in court that Carl Clifford had been reading material, watching material by Andrew Tate, the self-described misogynist influencer. And it's something that the government has talked about trying to tackle the influence of people like Andrew Tate. I just wonder, how might you go about doing that?
I'm absolutely thrilled that we've got a government that is taking this seriously and treating violence against women and girls that is usually by men as a national emergency and committed to halving it. But how do you reduce his influence? I mean, where do you even start? Jess and the team at the Home Office and then Minister Davis Jones, they've got a really ambitious plan around it. As a mum of two boys, they've grown up in a really, you know, feminist household with a great dad that's a good role model for them. And they're still telling me that they think that Andrew Tate has a point. And I've got an 11-year-old, my little baby, and she's about to go to big school. And rape crisis tell me there's 9 in 10 chance that she'll either be sexually harassed or be sent indecent images while she's at secondary school. The world just seems really scary. And I think that the way that we tackle that is, yes, the government have got a huge role here. And I'm thrilled to see the action that they're taking. But anybody that's interacting with young men needs to be talking to them about consent and about how inappropriate the stuff is that Andrew Tate is saying.
Because you can't stop people accessing his material, what he writes, what he posts online, can you?
No, there's the internet. It brings so many good things, but it also brings some really scary things. I'm part of the Women and Equalities Committee, and we've been doing some stuff around revenge porn and deep fakes. And the internet can be a really scary place, which is why the conversations in schools, the conversations in workplaces and at kitchen tables with our young people are really important. We've got to teach them that just because they see something on the internet doesn't mean that it's true.
I mean, the previous government also said that it wanted to tackle this issue of violence against women and girls. It had a strategy back in 2021 that it published. What is it about this government that it's going to do differently?
I felt really good in the chamber today. We had the International Women's Day debate and we heard some harrowing stories. There were tears and there was real heartache. The difference is that when Jess Phillips read those names, it's the 10th year that she's read the names of the women that have been killed in the previous year. And it was different this time because there are more women sat behind her. She was saying it from the dispatch box. We've nearly half of Parliament are women now. Half of the government are women. In the last Parliament, football was mentioned more than rape. We've now got a minister that and a Home Secretary that take it and a Prime Minister that take it incredibly seriously. They are treating it as a national emergency. Things like getting specialist officers in courts, increasing the sitting days, making sure that we've got extra police on the street. This is delivery that we didn't see under the last government.
The Labour MP for Bolsover, Natalie Fleet there. Main headline so far on The World Tonight. Ukrainian and American delegations are to meet next week in Saudi Arabia to discuss what's been described as a framework for peace. President Zelensky has said he'll lead his country's team. The Vatican's released the first audio message recorded by Pope Francis since he was taken to hospital with pneumonia nearly 3 weeks ago. The recording was played during a nightly prayer service for the Pope in St. Peter's Square. And in another story, the daughter of the COVID pandemic fundraiser, Captain Sir Tom Moore, has told the BBC she deeply regrets that a charity was set up in his name. Hannah Ingram Moore says the decision almost derailed the family's life, but claimed nothing dishonest happened. Mrs. Ingram Moore and her husband became directors of the Captain Tom Foundation, but are accused by the Charity Commission of benefiting personally from the organisation. She's been speaking to Justin Dealey on BBC Three Counties Radio.
For those people that maybe did feel a bit misled, would you like to say anything to those people now?
I'm sorry they feel misled. I genuinely am. But there was never any intent to mislead. And if there was any misleading, it wasn't our doing.
The Charity Commission have asked you on numerous occasions to make a donation to charity. Are you going to do that?
We have made. Much money has gone. It's already happened. And they also know that.
Can you be more specific in terms of how much money from the book advance was spent on the Captain Tom Foundation to help it launch?
Do you know what? I don't think that's even the right thing to do. I don't think it's helpful now for me to put another number out because that's the number everyone will talk about. So there is nothing dishonest about what happened. The book said it would support the launch and it did.
And you can hear more from Hannah Ingram Moore on the Captain Tom story on BBC Sounds. Now, President Trump has suspended most of the tariffs he imposed on Mexico and some on Canada a day after they came into effect. The pause lasting a month is for goods that comply with a free trade agreement he signed back in 2020. Mr. Trump denied he was responding to sharp falls on US stock markets. Canada says it's studying the details. So what next for those tariffs? Let's talk to Kimberly Clausing, who's professor in tax law and policy at UCLA. She previously served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Tax Analysis at the US Treasury under the Biden administration. Welcome to The World Tonight, Kimberly. And I understand you're no fan of these tariffs, but why do you think Donald Trump has reversed course so swiftly?
I think ultimately every president cares about their economic record, and the markets have made clear that these tariffs aren't just bad for consumers at the store, but they're really quite bad for American production. If you look at our imports, more than half of them are intermediate goods, which means you're actually making it harder, not easier, to make things in the United States if you raise costs on all of the imports. And I think the president has probably heard from a lot of business interests in recent days about how harmful that would be to North American production. Whether he sticks with his original policy in a month is somewhat unclear. He seems so far to be a little bit the boy who called tariff rather than someone who's sort of sticking with his original policy plans.
I mean, one of his election pledges was to bring down inflation and bring down the cost of goods. I mean, do you think people were saying to him, look, this is actually going to push those costs up and pretty soon?
Yes, I think that's abundantly clear that prices will go up. And we're seeing that already in the store as firms are facing constraints in anticipation of these tariffs, because there's been a lot of orders placed that are difficult to fill. The question is kind of whether that those higher prices will ultimately cause a rethinking of the policy. You've heard some statements from administration officials saying, well, people are just going to have to deal with higher prices. The Treasury Secretary said something that was just reported in the news about how the American dream doesn't mean a lot of cheap goods from abroad. But I think that they will find that American consumers are quite sensitive to price increases and won't enjoy, after a long period of inflation in 2022 and 2023, they won't enjoy a return to higher prices when they go to the store or the lumberyard.
What will be exempt? I mean, it's goods that effectively comply with this free trade agreement, the successor to NAFTA involving the US, Canada and Mexico. And it was, I mean, as I mentioned, Donald Trump that signed that, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed. So that makes this particularly perplexing because you would normally think that a country wouldn't want to tariff its closest trading partners and the countries that are really, you know, quite good friends in general with respect to international affairs. So this targeting of those two countries is particularly odd, especially after, with great fanfare, NAFTA was renegotiated and relabeled as USMCA. So the fact that his own trade agreement is the first one he's picking on is peculiar, to say the least.
Just very briefly, do you think, I mean, he talked about just a little disturbance caused by these tariffs, but do you think he was pretty rattled by the way that US stock markets have behaved?
Yes, I think that probably is causing some concern in the administration. The stock market has made abundantly clear, and you can even see it as he's announcing things. You can watch the market drop when he's announcing tariff increases and rise when he's announcing respites. So unless he's trying to, you know, short the market, I think it doesn't really make sense to do all this yo-yoing back and forth. It creates a lot of business uncertainty and investor uncertainty. Okay. So I think the economic damage is there, regardless of whether the market rebounds a bit.
But, Kimberly,
you know, I think he'd be wise to rethink these policies.
Kimberly, thank you very much indeed. Kimberly Clausing, Professor of Tax Law and Policy at UCLA. Well, we're staying with relations between US and Canada, because in these turbulent times, many of us are turning to nature for some respite. But what if the natural world suddenly turns into a mirror of what's happening politically? Well, that's exactly what a Canadian photographer found out while walking beside a frozen lake in Ontario. A bald eagle, America's national emblem, preparing to attack a lone Canada goose. His image has gone viral in Canada, where people are seeing it as a metaphor for the country's attempt to challenge President Trump's rhetoric. Well, the photographer is Mervyn Sequeira, and he takes up the story.
I was out with my camera like I do every morning, and I was by this frozen lake. It was frozen as far as the eye could see. And I watched this bald eagle coming in. It's not unusual to see bald eagles there. We have them there. But this one seemed to have had purpose, and it headed straight for a goose that was isolated far out on the ice. And it went in for the attack. So that went on for about 20 minutes. The bald eagle attacked the goose repeatedly. The goose defended itself as best it could. There were several bouts. They'd take a break and catch their breaths and, I guess, think about what the next strategy would be. And at the end of 20 minutes, when I thought that it was over for the goose, the bald eagle just gave up and flew away, and the goose walked away.
How do these sorts of encounters normally end? Presumably not well for the goose.
First of all, it's a bit unusual for a bald eagle to take on a Canada goose, because weight for weight, they are so similar. They'll usually go in for smaller waterfowl like ducks and whatever else. So this one was a bit of a challenge. It's possible that the goose was not well. That's possibly why it was isolated. And again, that's another reason why the eagle picked on it. I've never seen a bald eagle go in for a goose before. I've seen them take other things. So in that respect, it was unusual. I was surprised that the bald eagle actually gave up.
I mean, it all, as you describe it, it does all sound like a metaphor, and you know where I'm heading with this. While you were watching this unfold, was that at all going through your mind?
It wasn't. At that time, ask any wildlife photographer, nothing else is going through their mind. They're just firing off with that shutter and hoping to get the best shots. It was sub-zero temperatures. The light was poor. They were way out in the distance. So I had to do everything I could to make the most of it. And it was only when you get home and start looking through the pictures that you've got, you know, you've got a couple of good ones. And after you start posting them, then the feedback comes in, and then you know that people quite naturally, because of the very names of the two birds, are putting a political spin on it.
Did it click at all when you got back home, or was it only when you started to realise the response that you made the connection, if you like? And I have to say, the photos are fabulous.
I won't say it was only when I got the responses, but there is a climate just now where things are not as happy as they should have been. So I'm trying to choose my words here. Because I like to stay out of this.
Maybe you need to be like the goose. You need to be combative, defending yourself.
I did expect it to take on this sort of a twist, but it only dawned on me as I started processing the pictures and started posting them.
Were you surprised by the scale of the reaction, though?
I had no idea at all that it would reach the staggering proportions that it has just now.
And that must tell you a lot about the sort of situation, well, that Canada's in, and also, you know, what a polarised world we're living in at the moment.
You've said it, and you've said it beautifully.
Your friends and neighbours and you know, sort of immediate neighbourhood around you, I mean, is there any sign of the sort of wider geopolitical battle that is going on between Canada and the United States? I mean, are people talking about boycotting American goods? Is it something that people are talking about on the doorstep?
Everybody is concerned. Everybody is hoping to do what they can do to help the situation in whatever way they can.
Do you think your photos have given comfort to Canadians? They look at the metaphor and they go, hold on, you know, normally in this situation, the goose might end up as the eagle's dinner, but not in this case.
I can quite confidently say that. And yes, because all the responses I've got on Instagram are saying just that. So it is comforting.
It does suggest, though, that, you know, I mean, it's not a new medium, is it? And we're surrounded by new media that is playing havoc with the world, some might say, in all sorts of different ways. But photography, that old visual medium, still has an extraordinary power, doesn't it?
Yes, they've always said a picture says more than 1,000 words or whatever it is. But there you are.
Photographer Mervyn Sekeira. Now, in just under 3 weeks' time, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will announce her spring forecast. Not another budget, but a chance to respond to the Office of Budget Responsibility's own revised forecast for the economy currently being prepared. And it's fair to say that since the budget last October, the world has changed a lot. Tensions over Ukraine, those American tariffs, they've pushed up the cost of borrowing. There's also an increase in defence spending to pay for, and all this against a backdrop of inflation that's edging up again and weak growth. So what are the Chancellor's options? It's something the IFS, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, has been looking at in a new paper. Its Deputy Director Carl Emerson spoke to me about whether Rachel Reeves will be able to stick to her fiscal rules.
The key thing is that Rachel Reeves chose to set herself rather strict pass-fail fiscal targets and give herself next to no wiggle room against them. So it only takes a relatively modest downgrade in the forecast for her to be left with a choice between breaking the rule or being forced into taking action to avoid breaking it.
Do you think she will break her own fiscal rules?
The speculation seems to be that a combination of things like a bit more spending on debt interest over the next few years as interest rates are a little higher, weakness in the government's receipts so far this year, and weakness in the outlook for the economy suggests that she will be on course to miss it. I would be surprised if she just leaves it at that, though. I think what will happen is she will announce measures, i.e. some combination of measures to increase revenue or to cut spending, which puts her back on track to meet it. So she won't have to stand up in Parliament and say she's missing her fiscal target, but she will have to stand up and say, here's some measures that I'll be implementing, and as a result, we remain on course.
And might one of those measures be spending cuts? There's been quite a lot of speculation about the scale of that, reportedly asking departments to identify what the sort of low-hanging fruit, 20% of the budget that might be vulnerable to cuts.
And I think there's two types of areas she might look for cuts to spending. One would be on working age benefit expenditure, where in particular the numbers receiving and the amounts being spent on health-related benefits has been going up a lot and is forecast to continue rising. So if she may well be tempted to try and implement measures just to slow the growth in that spending, which could save quite a bit. The other area is public services, where I think it's much trickier because we know the government has lots of aspirations for what it wants to do to the NHS. We know the defence budget's going up, and lots of the other areas of government are either things like education, where you could imagine a Labour government being quite keen, or areas of government where actually there were really quite big cuts through the 2010s, like the justice budget. So finding easy cuts there are not going to be easy.
How much might she be able to find, and would that enable her to meet her fiscal targets in the short term?
Well, there's been speculation that some of the changes to working age benefits might save something of the order of £5 billion. It remains to be seen whether that's the case and whether the official forecaster will sign off on that kind of costing.
Is that a year?
£5 billion a year. Mm-hmm. It would still mean spending more by the end of this parliament than what we're currently spending, but it would mean cutting the growth rate and the planned growth rate in the spending. In terms of day-to-day public service spending, she could save about £10 billion a year by the end of the parliament if she felt able to be actually less generous over the next few years than what Jeremy Hunt was planning to be. So you can do that if you want to, but it would have some pretty difficult choices for the spending review that's going to slice up the cake in June. So at the end of this month, we will just hear about how much money is going to be made available in total. The hard bit would be getting individual cabinet ministers to agree to settlements between now and June to make those numbers add up. Easy wins there.
And the pledge to increase defence spending, what impact is that likely to have?
Well, between now and 2027-28, in some sense, it's been funded. So it's not making the problem for domestic public services any worse, any harder, because the government has said that they want to increase defence spending, but it'll be pretty much paid for by spending less than previously planned on overseas aid.
So what does this mean for all of us? I mean, is it a return to some sort of austerity?
I think if Rachel Reeves does choose to trim back on those public service plans, it's going to mean cuts to some areas of government. Doubtless some areas will still see increases, like the NHS, but there'll be cuts in some places. She could make some choices on the tax side too, and perhaps the most obvious thing she could choose to do is that at the moment, because of policies set out by the last Conservative government, pretty much every threshold in the tax system is being frozen through to March 2028. She could choose to extend that freeze on thresholds for another couple of years. That would mean more people paying income tax, more people paying the higher rate of income tax. The attraction for the Chancellor is it's a fairly credible thing to do. People perhaps might not notice that as a tax rise quite as much, and it would raise her perhaps about £10 billion a year by the end of the Parliament.
Carl Emerson, thanks for listening. Good night.